Welcome to Your Weekly Dose podcast, the only show for those who missed the Mark and Brian radio program. Coming to you from Orange County in Southern California. Hear it happen live without a net every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Download past episodes directly from our website, yourweeklydose.com. But if you're on the go, subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, and make sure you leave a review. Now, here's this week's show.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry to say that we are not here today. Today's show is going to be a past moment show. And of course, we're playing Back Home Again by the Partridge Family. And we will be back home, all four of us, next week. But until then, we're going to give you guys two wonderful interviews. First one's going to be by Larry Saltis, a friend of mine, who was in the band The New Monkees and also is in currently a band called Colorvine. And also Tyler Hilton, actor, singer. Hopefully you guys would enjoy his interview that we did with him as well. In the meantime, please don't forget to support the show by going to our website, yourweeklydose.com. Click on the Amazon banner and bookmark. And shop to your heart's delight, because every time you shop, they give us a little bit of money to stay on the air. So let's get right down to business. Here, our first interview again is with Larry Saltis. And our second interview is with Tyler Hilton. Here we go.
I'm on my way back home again.
Well, our guest today has led a very interesting life. By the time he was 16, his band caught the attention of legendary producer Paul Rothchild. He's produced like The Doors, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, you know, small-time people. but 2 years later, our guest would decide for some strange reason to audition for a TV sitcom called The New Monkees. And by George, he became one. Good Lord. Then in 1995, his band Colorvine released their first album, which was then nominated for a Grammy. After taking some time to raise a family, our guest decided to pick up his guitar again and start writing. Now, after a sold-out performance with The New Monkees with special guest Mickey Dolenz recently this past February, Colorvine returns with a new life, a new album called Wake Up. The first single from the album is called Victory Song, which was our theme song this morning. So please welcome to the show someone I'm proud to call friend, Mr. Larry Saltis.
Well, hey, how are you, Sean?
Good,
thank you,
brother.
Very much.
How are you, my friend?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. How's everything out in Ohio?
Everything out in Ohio today is really nice. It's beautiful, sunny, and 52 degrees.
Ooh, that does sound nice, especially for Ohio.
Yeah, it's really nice. Cool. I'll take it. Now, it'll snow tomorrow night, they say, so it's
going to
change.
Oh, geez. There you go. Like, man, just when I got my shorts on, now I got to put my knickers on, too.
How's it out there?
Right now, SoCal, it's a little, it's kind of cool too. It's overcast though, so we got some heavy clouds and everything, but it's not too bad. It's probably like in the low 60s right now.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Excellent. So for, you know, an Ohio person, you know, it's a heat wave.
Absolutely. It is.
Well, thanks for being on the show, buddy. I really appreciate it, of course. And, you know, last week you and I had a really wonderful conversation, so it's going to kind of be a reminisce of that. But let's take things from the beginning for you. How'd you get started playing into music, and how old were you when you started?
I started playing guitar around 7 years old. And my introduction to guitar was with an acoustic at that time. And a local guy here who lived in Copley, Ohio, was my first teacher. He was a high school kid who just had a knack for singing and playing guitar at the same time. So I started singing and playing guitar. That's how I started. A lot of people just start with theory and all that, but that's what I started with. And then it graduated into theory when I went into classical guitar when I was about, I'd say, 11 or 12. And then it really took off because I really just got into classical. I stopped really singing as much with the guitar and all that and got into classical music. By the time I was 14, I was attending master's classes at Akron University in their program there. And it really didn't take a turn to where I got out of theory and back into singing and playing until my dad and mom got me an electric guitar.
Wow.
And the agreement was, hey, if we give this to you, you got to promise us that you'll still continue to play classical guitar, but we thought you should do this. Well, that's what happened. I did, and I never touched the classical guitar again.
As you should. Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
How supportive were your parents, though, for you?
How? I'm sorry?
How supportive were your folks?
Very. I'd say it was unordinary. Is a good word. You know, you had a dad who was a doctor at the time. You had a mom who was a working lady as well, and a housewife. And both of them, though, were very supportive of me just doing music. They thought it was great. As long as I did all the other things, of course. You had, you know, good grades and played a sport and, you know, kept busy, so on and so forth.
Your spinach. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't like it, but I ate it.
Yeah. Well, you got to put ketchup on it. It tastes a lot better.
Is it really?
I have no idea.
I was going to say, that sounds pretty gross. But
so, God, 7 years old, man. I mean, that's pretty young. I mean, because Marty, we were talking to Marty, you know, he started fairly young himself. He was like 3 or 4 years old. Did getting the guitar at that age, did it seem like, were you like a fish in water at that point? Or did you struggle a little bit?
The only thing I really struggled with was practicing. Everything else seemed sort of natural. It fit my hands, it fit my body. It was something that my hands seemed to be able to do.
Wow.
So it wasn't a real struggle there. When it was a real struggle would be in the classically oriented stuff, you know, learning how to play classical guitar and going through the theory of it and playing Carl Lavaro and Segovia and all that stuff is really not easy. That's when it became more of a work practice thing. But anytime it was singing and songwriting, or, you know, singing songs on the radio, it seemed natural. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was less work, but it was work. You know, you really wanted to make it right. And you learn really quickly where you should be, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. Because I kind of started the same way, where I'm mainly self-taught, but I learned kind of like you. I learned to play and sing at the same time. And I know some people say that's like a very difficult thing to do. And I'm going, really? I see almost a lot of people do it, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't think it was a small percentage. So I just thought it was the normal thing to do.
Right. Or the thing you just do because that's all you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So with now all this experience and everything, you're getting older, you're going to high school and stuff, you got this band going. How old were you when you wrote your first song?
I'm going to say 15.
Do you remember what it was about?
Yeah. It was called Forever. It was a love song about using the word forever, and it's a word I'll never use again. I imagine my own heartbreak, because, you know, when I'll be honest with you, Sean, I did not have a bad childhood. Uh-huh. I was raised in a very safe area, safe school system, safe everything. Uh-huh. And when you're raised that way and you don't have a lot of hardship,
it's
you manufacture things to make you feel more real. And so,
dude, I can totally relate.
Good.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Because I feel ashamed sometimes that I grew up so well, because later in life things got bad, you know? So now I look at kids who I meet kids today who are really having a hard time and struggling in life. Uh-huh. And I didn't have that. It flip-flopped for me. I had that later. So I would never want a child to go through the tough times you're going through, but it's more realistic. The world's tough.
Right.
So when you sat down and wrote a song at 15 in my predicament, uh-huh. I manufactured a disgruntled relationship with a girl.
Wow. Mine was about going to the shopping mall during Christmas. I kid you not. I kid you not.
That's awesome, though. It was real.
Yeah, it was. Because, like you said, that's all I knew, you know. And like you, and that's one thing I really enjoyed about our conversation last week, is that you and I have a lot of parallels that are the same, you know.
We do.
And
yeah, we
do. You know, and same thing. My parents were very supportive parents in other ways. Not that much supportive of the music, because they just didn't understand it. But Yeah, like you, I didn't have a bad childhood at all. I had a great childhood. And so, yeah, so when it came time for me to write songs, like, what are you going to write about, you know? And I'm not angry about anything, you know? And it's like, well, let's write about the shop, going to the shopping mall, you know, and buying toys and things and this and that for mom and dad and sister and brother, you know?
That's
and
awesome.
I felt like I was writing a song for Happy Days or something, you know?
Well, good for you, though.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, approaching songwriting itself, has it changed for you over the years?
Yes.
How so?
I'd say by the age of 16, when we were working with Atlantic Records, sending demos back and forth and figuring out the industry and how songs are really written, and then going to Los Angeles Songwriter Showcase by the time I was 16 and 17 and getting into that.
Off.
Well, I say that because it was so valuable. I had experiences that a lot of people don't have at a young age, and I really learned. And I'm like a sponge anyways. I'm not a very charismatic, pushy guy. I'm not going to voice my opinion about anything. I'm going to listen.
Right.
And that, you know, being that way at that young, that's when you're impressionable. And that's when I really learned that songwriting, it does have a craft. It does have a formula. It doesn't, it's not restricting. I don't mean that, but you learn how to put a song on the radio. If that's what you want to do, you got 30 seconds to get someone's attention. You better get to the point. And by the way, you better write about something that people want to hear about. So all those things you have to think about.
Yeah. Cause people don't want to hear Forever or shopping malls. So
they really don't.
No, they don't. Yeah, trust me. Yeah, that song's never. Yeah,
but that's when I think songwriting's changed. It got more serious for me. And then if you really fast forward into the Color Vine days and Tower City days, I think what happened was I was writing for the wrong reasons. I think my brother would agree with me and everybody in the band at the time. We wrote to be rock stars.
Uh-huh.
That's what you wrote to be. And that meant that you really, you started veering the other way, which was to go ahead and take a path of what you thought was going to make you money.
Got
That's
it.
When songwriting changes.
Got it. Okay. So, and so for you, you're saying that was the wrong reasons. What was it that you were writing about versus, let's say, when you were taking the songwriting classes themselves?
I think you had topic, and then you had things to worry about, such as rhyme and meter and, you know, arrangement. And you had to mix all those things together, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, that becomes unnatural at that point.
Oh, gotcha.
It's good. It's good for you, but it's not natural. You're not sitting down just writing a song because you feel it anymore. You're thinking about all those things. When that came into the picture, everything sort of changed. And I think what happens when you get older is you realize, what am I doing this for? Do I really enjoy it? What do I enjoy about it? And like you, Sean, now you sit down with a guitar and you just let it go.
True.
You just tell the story because you have a story. You're old enough to have one, by the way.
Right.
You've lived life. You tell a story and you hope that it really appeals to someone else who's either been through the same thing as you have, or they can just identify because you're speaking the same language.
So basically for you, then is that the reason why you said you kind of almost had to manufacture it as at a younger age? Cause there wasn't that much experience there.
Yeah, absolutely. I hadn't done anything. I hadn't lived anything. I hadn't really felt pain. I hadn't felt pure joy. I hadn't had to get a job.
Right.
You know, I none of that.
Wow,
I didn't have a family. I mean, I didn't have a wife. You know what that's like? How can you talk about anything
right.
if you don't have a story?
Which really amazes me, because I think if you think back, because you and I are only a couple of years apart.
Yeah.
When you think, you go back in time and you look at people, especially, I'm really show our age, but somebody like Debbie Gibson, though, really did everything. She produced, she recorded, you know. And to catapult her career at that of a young age, but where it sounded like she showed experience, though. I mean, that was really tough to do.
Yeah. She had a gift then at that age that I don't know if I would have been able to have unless I had a certain opportunity. She was on Atlantic, wasn't she?
I think so, yeah.
And, you know, that's a big difference between the letter I got from Atlantic saying, hey, we need to wait till you get into college and we'll do something with you.
Mm-hmm.
That was different. She just had it. She had something that they knew was not manufactured. It was ready to go, and they did it.
Yeah, because she,
was 17.
Yeah, she did everything herself, you know, which blew me away. You know, at that point, and I'm going, damn, you know, as Bubble, if you look back, as Bubble Pop, as much as it was, whatever, those songs still hold up today.
They do. She's just a good writer.
Yeah.
Good singer, good performer, everything. She had the whole package.
Yeah, because, I mean, every time she said, you know, Shake Your Love, I'm like, okay, and I did it, you know, and I just wanted to go out and just, like, go for it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of experienced it a little bit myself, so I could kind of understand, and you're right, as you do get older, you do have more experiences what you can write about, whether I think it's sending a message to a younger generation or a message to a friend or a spouse or whatever, or just observing, you know, kind of a thing. Exactly. I think that's the biggest thing. With songwriting in general for you, Larry, what type of songwriter are you? Because I know there's people who, you know, you got the Nashville guys. They go in, like, it's like a job, 9 to 5. They go into a bungalow or they meet somewhere or whatever, and they try to write all day long. Are you one of those type, or are you the type where you'll write when it comes to you?
I'm the latter. I'll write when it comes to me. You know, the Colorvine Wake Up record, my brother and Danny and I, when we got together to do this, it was when we had time, you know, and because you have real jobs, you have real families, you have a lot of responsibilities. And when you break away for time, that's all you got. So if you're moved at the time and you have a good idea, it's usually starting with a guitar riff, and then you start with a melody, and then you say, what do I want to talk about? And just so I think you know this, Sean, already, I'm a collaborator guy. I'm not an independent guy. I can't sit down and write a song on my own and ever get it done. It just never happens because I just don't feel good enough about it anyways, and I need other people in the room to work off of. And that's why I'm a collaborator.
Gotcha. I think it's best to collaborate. I mean, I think some of my – I could probably say some of the songs that I've written, maybe about three I'm very proud of where – they're very solid, you know.
Yeah.
But where I wrote both words of music, but I think some of my better work is definitely through collaboration because you have that someone else to bounce off of, you know.
Yes.
that partner and go, well, let's try this. Well, let's try that. Well, I don't know. Well, let's try it anyway. Okay. And you go, oh shit, I was wrong. It does work, you know, kind of a thing. And it's kind of cool because you do have that, and then you get that camaraderie with that person, and next thing you know, you learn how each other's works. I mean, look at the great Elton John and Bernie Taupin.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly. And it's always nice to have someone in the room. You know, like I have my brother. I mean, you can't do better than that. And then I have another member, Danny, that's like a brother. Uh-huh. We've known each other so long, so accountability comes in. If I've got a song, they'll tear it apart.
They
really will.
How tough is that with your brother, you know, going, because, I mean, it's not a friend or whatever. It's not, you know, you got your brother as a work partner also. How critical is he on you?
Very. As I am with him. Very critical. You know, when I have an idea for a lyric and I bring it in and I start singing it, he'll say, no. Here, let's try this, or vice versa. If he comes in with an idea and I'll say, no. But it's not with the intent to hurt each other.
Right.
It just works because I know he's not doing something to hurt me. It's he's going to make it better.
He's looking at the big picture overall.
Yeah, it's the macro of all of it. You know, it works.
What were your main influences growing up as far as songwriters or just bands that you admired?
Bands in general that were really good songwriters. You know, Journey just sticks out. It's always my go-to. Uh-huh. That's my go-to. Reason being is if you look at the talent in the band, you looked at the way it was developed, the way it came out. They were artists, musicians, songwriters, the whole package. That's what I wanted to be. That was my model. And that's pretty much what I always stuck with. Everybody else came along, you know, U2 is, I love U2. I love the fact that their longevity and their creative heart, how they can change and do whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. There's only a few that come out on my tongue, but I've learned to appreciate the 70s a lot more as I've gotten older.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I tell you what, when you get into the Lynyrd Skynyrd stuff or you know, Steve Miller Band, the different style, Joe Walsh is my favorite guitar player of all time, along with Neil Schon. But you look at that whole the era of music from the 70s to the 80s and the just the change up to about 1986.
Mm.
What a great time to live through musically. AC/DC and Foreigner, I mean, all that stuff. What a great time to listen to and have bands. And then the English Invasion again that came with Duran Duran and everybody else that came along with them. Incredible.
Yeah.
Great time to grow up. You had a wide range of musical styles and abilities, and that was the model for you. So anybody who, like you and I, who grew up through that era, I believe has an advantage if later in life they're able to write again. They're able to take all those things and put them into something because mm-hmm. it's part of you. It's not manufactured at all. You're not trying to be anybody. You just grew up with that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the Wake Up record is about.
For me, it was a little bit of a crossover because I don't know how old your folks are, but my parents were pre-war babies, basically.
Yeah.
They were born in 39 and 40. So by the time they finished high school, which was 57 and 58, I mean, they were at the beginning of rock and roll. You know,
wow.
They saw Elvis for the first time. They saw the Beatles for the first time, you know, kind of thing. They would watch Ricky Nelson all the time and go to his concerts and stuff as when Rick was 17, you know, and out touring.
Yeah.
I think that the hardest rock my mom ever really listened to was Trini Lopez, you know.
Wow.
And who we fortunately got to interview on the show. And, you know, so for me, that's what I kind of grew up with, was that 50s style of lyric or attitude, you know. And then, like you said, tried to mix that in with the 70s rock flavor, you know, of Foreigner or even Bad Company, you know, or something or whatever. It really threw a weird mixture for me. And I think that's kind of what makes my sound a little bit different also, because I'm throwing those two things together.
Exactly. And imagine, you know, remember ELO, right?
Oh yeah.
And Steppenwolf.
Oh,
you know,
God.
I grew up listening to Steppenwolf.
Yeah.
So my models were, you know, good songs, just really strong stuff, but not angry, but at the same time, you know, what's the right word? What's the word you describe Steppenwolf?
Well, it's just good feeling, really.
Just good stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Just good feeling songs.
Except for the Pusher. But
well, there's some innuendos in that one there, Larry. So I have no idea what the innuendos are, but, you know, that's okay. So here you are, man. I mean, you're Atlantic Records approached you and everything. Mm-hmm. They said, hey, you know, we want to wait till you guys get out of high school, and then we may do something, you know, and I'm sure you're ecstatic. And then you did this left turn
mm-hmm.
where you decided to audition for the New Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking?
Well, it's a good question. I wish it was as exciting of an answer for you, except just to say that the old cliche in the pilot itself, that, you know, my mom and dad had the two tickets on my table in the kitchen table coming in from soccer practice and instead, hey, you're going to New York.
Wow.
Like, well, why am I going to New York? Well, because you need an opportunity to know what a cattle call audition is.
So we could honestly say that this is your parents' fault then.
Yeah. If we want to go ahead and revert and blame our parents for everything, let's do it right now because I'll do it. There you go.
I love it, man. So your mom and dad made it's their fault that you became a New Monkey. I love it.
Yeah. That's a good way of saying it.
Wow. That changes it now in retrospect, doesn't it, Larry?
Sure does. Wow, the load's off my shoulders.
So. So that whole process for you, man, what was that like to go through the auditions and everything? Because I know with Dino and Marty and Jared, it was completely different. You know, they called Marty, and Marty, you know, basically told us, you know, he goes, dude, I didn't want to be a monkey. You know, you called me. You know, kind of a thing.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
So what was it like for you actually going to the cattle call?
Just scary. You know, it was my mom and I flew to New York because my dad had to work. So we flew in and I stood in line the first day for about 5-6 hours.
Wow.
I think it was 42nd Street where SIR Studios was at the time, or 47th, one of the two. But and I was the only guy dressed up. You know, a lot of people just came as they were. I think I was a little more dressed up. As a matter of fact, the guys that came and just stood behind us, about, you know, 2 hours out down the line, said, "What'd they do, fly in Duran Duran for the audition?" And started laughing. And these guys are rockers. They looked like the Ramones.
So
it was really, really bad. It was scary. I didn't really want to be there at that time. Finally got into the line, and I only had a 30-second interview. It was so fast.
Wow.
You know? And they just said, "Okay, we're going to have to," I think it was Matt Fassbrug who interviewed me. He ended up being one of the producers. He just said, "How about you stay in town and we get you to the second stage auditions?" And I said, I don't know if I can do that.
Really?
Yeah, I'm 18 years old. What are you talking about? Stay another day.
But you had your mommy with you, though.
That's right. So we stayed another day, and I had to have my guitar FedExed overnight because I knew no other thing except I had to have my guitar now.
Wow.
I didn't know you know, people provided guitars for you. I know this sounds crazy, but I didn't know that.
Right.
So we had it shipped. I think it cost like $35 back then to do it. But, and that's how I got in the door. The next day was scary. Wake up in New York and you're going to go to SIR Studios again. And I was not standing in line this time, though.
Well, because hopefully the Ramon guys aren't there anymore.
No, and what's funny, those guys I became friends with through that, and I remember they ended up being in the pilot, the one brother, and the thing was, everybody was going in and doing Monkees songs.
Right. Big mistake.
I didn't know that till after my audition the next day. I didn't know that. Uh-huh. That's partly why I got noticed.
Wow.
I didn't go in there to do it. I did an NXS song. You know, at the time.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So wow. And they stopped me after about 30 seconds of playing. It was that quick. But, you know, before that, you know, David Sanborn walked in the room, Mark Goodman from MTV, some other people who you would recognize walked into the room right before I start playing.
Jeez. Talk about pressure.
So, yeah. But, you know, it's funny. You get up there and you got a light on you. You just, you're stuck. That's it. You're stuck. You just do what you do. And I'm glad I did the NXX song because that's what I did. I was in a copy band. Right. You know, we made money as high schoolers doing copy songs. So it was natural.
Wow. So when did you get the phone call that you were now a new Monkee?
Let's see. The auditions were in August. I was at Kent State University. I was in for about 3 weeks into the program. The phone rings and it's Steve Blonner.
Oh, wow.
And the executive producer. And he said, "How do you feel about coming out to Los Angeles? You're one of the final nine."
Jeez.
And I said, once again, "I don't think I can do that." And he laughed. He said, "Oh, I love it. So naive." And I didn't realize what that comment meant at the time. So I said, "Well, I can't do that. I'm in the middle of the semester and blah, blah, blah." And he said, "I've already talked to your dad. We've already worked it out. You're coming out."
Oh, wow.
So that was it. He actually called my parents first, and then the rest came along, and I was out in L.A. before you knew it, about 2 weeks later, and had to go through the audition process.
So with the other band that you had going on, getting the attention of Paul Rothschild, then what happened to that?
Well, you know, we were young. We did what we did. We got into our own groove. We were more intent on doing demos and getting them off to Atlantic Records by that time. And Paul sort of fell to the wayside. He was working on other projects. So by the time I was 18, really, we were just looking to do a record deal. That was the focus.
And
when this came along, it seemed like just a good opportunity to get in front of the people and get around the networks that you needed to be around.
Wow.
So it just felt, I didn't think much, Sean. Yeah. How much can you think at 18? I couldn't think about anything. I'm like, here I am in Los Angeles. I'm on cameras. True. All this stuff's going around and I'm around famous people. And like, this has got to be the ticket. This has got to be the route.
How intimidated were you when you finally got out here, Larry? I mean, because like you said, I mean, you know, you're a kid, 18 years old, small town life from Ohio, comes out to Hollywood, and now you're, you know, thrust into, you know, the lights, the camera, everything and whatever. How intimidated were you on that?
I remember flying into Burbank Airport, getting picked up by the producers, and I end up getting stuck in the back of a Volkswagen convertible Rabbit. real quick, I realized that just because this is going your way doesn't mean that it, you just, you plop into Hollywood and you've got the limos and you've, you know, got the big condo and all, whatever you thought at that age, at 18.
Right.
That's,
yeah.
It wasn't that way.
What Hollywood's, you know, supposed to be. Right.
Right. So, when I got in, I was a little shocked by the fact that it wasn't what I was told it would be like.
Uh-huh.
It graduated into that. But at first there was that initial shock of, wow, you know, and I didn't understand why everybody hugged each other when they met and greeted each other. I didn't understand that, because we did that when you knew who you were hugging.
Right.
You know, that was a shock to me, but I got used to it.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, now here I am older. That's the only thing I do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you see someone, you hug them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cause you like people. At least I do now.
Well, that or you check for loose change. One of the two.
Well, yeah, I've had those moments too. It's amazing what you can find.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Trojan.
Yeah,
what's this for?
It was a shocker. It was a scary, but natural thing for me. All I wanted to do was be in LA. That's all I wanted to do since the time I was 16. It was underneath my senior picture in the yearbook. It said Los Angeles. You know, I wanted to be there.
Wow.
So here I am. And when that happens, you stop thinking.
Wow.
And that's what I did. I stopped thinking.
Was it just pretty much like a blur for you kind of a thing? And like, okay, where are we going? What are we doing or whatever? Or were you able to absorb it a little bit more?
I don't think I really ever absorbed it.
Wow.
I was just in it. Before I knew it, I was in. I did what I was told. I was told to be at places where I should be. I was told to go to acting lessons here. Or, you know, you're going to work with this guy at Columbia Music Group or, you know, whatever it is. And there was no time to think. Your days were full. And from that moment on, you were in the machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I knew.
Definitely was for you guys. So with all of that and everything, what are some, let's say one or two of your favorite moments of that whole experience?
It's funny how you would think the experiences that were your favorite when you're young are different when you're older. So all of them just flashed before me. I'd say one of the best experiences just to I was up at the Hollywood Lookout, and at the time, I think that's on Mulholland, you could actually drive into a parking lot area on the cliff overlooking Hollywood, and you could walk the trails down the hillside. Now you cannot do that.
Right.
But I went out there in the middle of the night, couldn't sleep, and I was living on Fuller Avenue in Hollywood with Dino from the New Monkees.
Uh-huh.
I remember being out there by myself, sitting on a rock, looking out over Hollywood and Los Angeles, and noticing the straight lines of all the streets and all the buildings. And I remember looking up and saying, why is it that I got chosen to be here like this? I remember asking that question.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the moments that have become my favorite moments, because I had no idea what was going on then, but now I do. And the other moment would be, I'd have to say when, after the New Monkees was over, sitting in an apartment by myself on Dickens Avenue in Sherman Oaks.
Uh-huh.
And just completely coming to the reality that I'm on my own.
Wow.
It's, you know, I'm on my own. I gotta do something.
Wow.
I can't go back home with this being over. Uh-huh. Without something in my hand. I've got to do something with myself. Those are the two moments that stick out.
Wow, that's pretty amazing, dude. That really is, because, I mean, they're both, I think, defining moments for you in your career. You know, A, what's going to happen with this new thing and how far is it going to go? Now that it's over with, I got to, you know, put my big boy pants on.
There you go.
You know, I must say, you know, because I watched the show, and I remember watching you and Dino, and this is where I was kind of, I think, a little envious at that time of, wow, these guys get to do this TV show and that TV show. Whatever. You got to meet Tony Orlando.
Yeah. Isn't that awesome?
Who is actually one of my favorite artists, you know, and I've had the pleasure of going to two of his concerts, and talk about being an entertainer, you know,
yeah,
and everything. who was the one that you were the, I think, starstruck the most out of all the people that you met during that whole time period?
Dick Clark.
Really?
Yeah, by far.
Wow.
I remember getting to shake his hand, introduced to him by Steve Blatter. Dean and I were standing next to each other at the time. Uh-huh. Actually, all New Monkeys, Marty and Jarrett were there. Uh-huh. So getting to meet him for me was the big deal. Wow. American Bandstand was my thing growing up. You know, I saw everybody on that thing.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And here he is standing right in front of me.
Wow. That's cool. Yeah. That's, yeah. Especially being a musician and everything.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. That's the ticket, right? He was the top.
Yeah.
He was the top.
So now here you are trying to decide this whole life moment thing, you know, after the New Monkeys and so forth. How tough was it for you after that being a musician? Did things seem to come a little bit easier for you? Or did things seem a little bit harder?
I'd say harder only because you're stuck with who you are. All these people aren't around you, giving you all these opportunities to shine. Uh-huh. So you have to figure out, okay, what am I? Well, I'm a guitar player, first and foremost. That's what I was.
Right.
Okay, what else? I'm a singer. Okay, what do you do with that? Well, you reach out to the people that you did work with and see what sticks. And, you know, you say, well, I guess I'm on my own. I better get up my chops again and start writing songs. And because I want a record deal. Mm-hmm. So I reverted back to what I really wanted at the time. I was, you know, 16 and had to make it work. And you move your brother out to L.A., you move your best buddy out to L.A., you guys put together the band again, and you go your route using connections that you had and, you know, throw stuff out there and see if anything sticks. Now, that seems like what everybody does. But for me, it was extremely hard. Because I was sort of just left in this city, and you know, the New Monkeys didn't tarnish me.
Right.
I never looked at it that way. It was an experience that I was blessed to be a part of, and blessed to meet all the people involved, and especially with the other guys in the New Monkeys themselves. Became very good friends out of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it was a plus for me, but I still had to go do what I wanted to do.
Right. Right.
But it's not that easy when all your contacts are gone.
True. You know, but you started to still create a little bit of waves though here, because now let me ask you this, like, because I'm not too sure. So the band in high school, was that also Color Vine or no?
That was called Scheme, S-C-H-E-M-E, and then Color Vine came after Tower City. Tower City was actually the first thing that happened when my brother and I were out in L.A.
Okay.
All right. It was called Tower City.
Okay. So Tower City, and that's what I wanted to find out, because I wasn't too sure if it was like Color Vine and then it changed to Tower City and then back to Color Vine or not. So I wanted to clarify that. So Tower City, what was the type of music that that Tower City played at the time then?
It became more or less a radio style, Def Leppard, Journey mixture.
Yes!
Brian Adams stuff. I mean, that's it, man. That was the ticket. That's the sound I wanted. And that's the sound my brother, we were all part of that. We loved that era. And you naturally become what's around you. And that's, we fell into that groove. And that's why we ended up working with people who knew that groove,
right?
Because they saw it. And then we had a manager named Don Arden, who is no small potato in the industry. And
no, not at all.
Came out of retirement to do that with us. You know, I was around very talented people, guitarists and producers. You know, Mike Slamber is a big name out there at that time. And so when you're in with good players, good producers, good writers, all you really got to learn to do is fight for what you want to be. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. You got lost in, hey, you're going to do this again. You're going to do that again, because this is what everybody else is doing. And that's how you're going to make it.
Got it. And how tough was it then to, let's say, okay, you know what? I'm done with it. I'm going to pack up and go back home. How tough was that decision for you?
My brother and I were talking about that the other night. It wasn't really a decision. It was a happening. And I was picking up a girlfriend that I had at the time from her waitressing job. Uh-huh. And I heard this song later. I guess Heath reminded me that we heard it in the car together. My brother Heath, and it was a song that came on the radio, and you just knew when you heard it, you wanted your stuff to sound like that. You wanted it to have that much feeling and passion. And you wanted it to be that aggressive, and you wanted it to be that imperfect. We had had a $500,000 production budget and a $500,000 promotional budget for the first single.
Jeez.
Okay, that's, we were at Atlantic at the time, Atco Records, actually. So that's what we were used to, and everything was polished. The production was polished. The music was polished. The vocals were polished. Well, then this song came out, and it happened to be Nirvana.
Oh, those bastards.
It smells like Teen Spirit. And when I heard it the first time, I remember just, I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And I think everybody else did.
Same here.
Yeah.
Yep. I loved it. But I knew. I said, this is the end. This is the end of the economics that we're used to in the music industry. All this money being spent and blown doesn't have to happen. Just let somebody be what they are and put it on tape.
Very true. Very true. Because I think up until then, it was, I think, one of the most raw things that we've heard, I would probably say, since some of the early, and I'm talking about like when they did their own stuff, their own demos of Guns N' Roses.
Yes.
You know,
you're right.
It was,
you're right.
Because GNR, when they first came out and everything, those first demos were very raw, very in your face. Because, I mean, at that time period, Poison was already signed and making a name. And, you know, they were headlining across the world. Warrant had just gotten signed themselves. And it was kind of like, who's going to be the next big one to come out of L.A.? You know,
yes.
And it was Guns N' Roses. And they changed just the way that whole pop metal sound became, you know. And then it was just a couple of years later after that, that, you, like you said, Nirvana came in and went, you know, kind of gave us all the middle finger and kind of went, we're going to be doing things a little bit differently now, boys. And then that,
yes,
that changed it for the next, yeah, 5 years.
Oh, it really changed the whole industry.
Yeah, it really,
I
did.
Think it really,
yeah,
did.
So you go off, you go back home to Ohio, you get married. Lovely wife, by the way. Oh my gosh, she's gorgeous.
Thank you. You as well, by the way. You've done well. You married up.
I tried. Oh yeah. Oh hell yeah, I married up. Are you kidding me? I got nowhere else to go but marry up. Yeah, come on, little Latino boy like me. Let's go.
Yeah, well, I reached for the stars on mine. I got really blessed. So
yeah, you did.
I'm good.
Yeah, you did. You got two great kids also, you know.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And so what made you decide to bring back and go back and do Color Vine? Why now, after all this time? Why a new album?
It wasn't my idea. And I don't think it was my brother's or Danny's either. What happened was they both put me into a room just to play my guitar again. Now, I put down the guitar. I didn't touch it for 12 years.
Right.
Okay. Just when my son came into my life and my wife, I had to have this life where I, you know, had to have my career and do what I need to do in construction and make things work, you know, and music wasn't at the time. So I just dropped it. And when I came back into the situation, it was with my old Les Paul again and an amp that I had to borrow. But,
wow.
But you know, I sat in the room with my brother and Danny on bass, and it was a very enjoyable experience for me, and it reminded me of what I really like to do as an outlet.
Uh-huh.
It just made me feel good. It made me feel just happy inside. Not that I wasn't a happy guy.
Right.
That was a different source of, I don't know, just...
It's kind of like... Going,
more like renewal.
Like, well, I was going to say, it's kind of like something like, oh yeah, that's what this feels like. That's what it's supposed to be about.
Thank you. Very well said. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a reminder. It was a great reminder of where I'd been, what I'd done, and why I did it, to the lengths that we had done it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it started. We graduated 4 months after that, after just meeting, you know, every other 2 weeks to play in my brother's basement into an actual rental unit. It was a big room. And then it went from there to another place where we've been ever since, called the Phoenix Room.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up recording a record in that room. And we did it knowing what we only knew how to do, which is the way you record records. No copying and pasting, even though you're in a digital age.
Right.
Actually sing every chorus, sing it.
Wow.
Every backup, sing it.
Right.
You know, every guitar part, play it. If you're going to double it, well, guess what? You're doubling it. And
right.
And that's the way it was done.
That's
now, why? I have no idea.
Well,
I mean, it was just enjoyable.
I think I think I could probably tell you why. It's what you're used to doing. It's used. That's how you work overall. I mean, when I sit in my studio and I'm ready to write a new song or create record something new, I'm the same way. You know, I'll take, you know, an electric guitar track. I'll double it up on an acoustic, pan them left and right or whatever. If it needs something else, I'll figure that out. But yeah, it's the old way of doing things. I think, you know, it's stacking it as if the band is there.
And you'll agree with me, right? If you have the opportunity to write music again and you're looking around, you're listening to the radio and you're saying, you know, something, not that I can control it, but something's missing.
Right.
And I think you would agree with me. You want to get back that feeling, not just of the anthemic rock, but you want to get back that feeling of Nirvana. You want to get the feeling of Journey. You want to get the feeling of AC/DC, whatever it is. You want that feeling. And it was that what music meant to us back then. It's different today.
It's that feeling of fun, I think, is what it
is.
Yes,
thank you.
Because, I mean, to me, music in general has always been an escape, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when I'm tired of music, you know, this is going to sound weird, but I get to go play with my wife, you know. when I'm tired of that, I get to go back to my music, you know. When I'm tired of that, now I have my son, you know. Hey, let's go out and go ride a bike or something or whatever, you know. When I'm done with him, then I go back to the music, you know. And it's that outlet, I think, is what it is. It always becomes fun. And I remember my dad gave me some great advice. He goes, when it stops becoming fun for you, stop. Take a break. You know?
There you go.
And he goes, it always has to be fun for you. And that's what it is. It does. I mean, I enjoy going out and doing these house concerts that I do. It's a little bit more stripped down because it's just me and an acoustic guitar. But it's like, I kind of miss that thing of being with a band now. And whether I'm playing guitar or being the lead vocalist, it doesn't matter. I miss that camaraderie of going out and entertaining crowds and watching people dance, especially the good-looking ones. You know, but entertaining people, you know, kind of a thing.
Well, that you just said it though too—the key word, band.
Yeah.
Now that's why Color Vine did Wake Up. We need more bands back. We need that feeling. That's why it's fun. That's the fun in the music is bands. Remember all the stories, all the songs that were hit songs written beforehand where you form a band and you want to be a rock star. Yeah. How many lyrics do we know from Tom Petty to Warner, whoever it is, that, you know, that it's about that, picking up that guitar, forming a band, learning how to play and going out and being a rock star.
Yeah.
That, you know, a band is a really cool thing, but I think it's what everybody else in the world who may not have you know, a musical gift, let's say. They love music, but I think first and foremost they love bands.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do you?
I yeah. Love, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because some of my favorite bands I like to go see is for specific reasons, you know. I don't care for bands that just stand there and do nothing and entertain.
Right.
I remember, God, who was it? damn, I can't remember their name right now, but it was a band that opened up for Van Halen one year, and they were just boring as hell. And my wife and I, we were dating at the time, and Larry, we're at the Forum in Los Angeles. I fell asleep.
Really?
Yeah. She had to wake me up and go, hey, Van Halen's coming out. Oh, okay. Because they were so boring. I've never seen that before, you know. And so, like, when I go out and see a band, I don't care who they are, you know, I want to be entertained. Entertain me. You know, because like I said, music is that escape for me. You know, take me there, create, you know, take me on this journey or whatever, you know. And I don't care if it's at the Forum. I don't care if it's at a club. You know, you need to entertain and carry that across. Give me that fun that I'm looking for.
That's right.
You know,
and that's why I'm relearning, you know, and you'll know more about this than I do, but I'm relearning what it's like to be a performer.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do a great job though, too. So
thanks, man. Thank you.
I saw the video and that was damn good acting there. Yeah. that was better than the new Monkees. I'll tell you that right now.
Oh, thank you.
With this new album and everything, is there a theme for this album or anything like that, that kind of underlies it? Or is it just, you know, just out there?
Thank you for asking. Yes, there is a theme, and it's deeper than the title. Even just saying "Wake Up," every song on there is music for everybody. Every story, every lyric that's told is content for everybody to listen to. The music itself is just an amalgam of everything you and I have been talking about and the things we love in music. From it's a band style, but every song can be broken down and played on the acoustic as well. We wanted to do that. We wanted to make sure that whatever you write and whatever you put out there, don't hide behind the production or the element of it. Just make sure it's a good song on its own.
Yeah.
Because if it's not good on its own, you can't sit down and play it. You know, don't do it.
Yeah.
It's just not, it's not accessible. So the message behind the record really is it's music for the people. We talk about this all the time. Mm-hmm. It's time to wake up. And just bring it back. We want to bring back radio music. We want to bring back the experience of hearing 6 out of 10 that move you.
Yeah.
Not just 1 out of 10. And we can't be the judges of that.
True.
The people are. And you, people like you who have taken the time to listen to it. Thank you, by the way.
Yeah.
You really, you can dig deep into it, and hopefully it's deeper than you expect. That's my favorite records, like you, Sean, are the ones that had 5 songs on them out of 10. And then even the other 5 you liked.
Right.
You didn't mind listening to them.
Yeah. No matter if it was like the weakest song or whatever, it didn't matter. You kind of go, yeah, it's okay. It's not that bad, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's great. Yeah. And I mean, you sent me some tracks and everything to listen to. I listened to every single one of them, and I thought everyone was, you definitely have a particular style for sure as a band, as an entity. But I did feel that every song stood on its own as well.
That's awesome.
And I thought it was very, very cool. What was when you guys decided to say, okay, let's record whatever, what was the writing process with your brother and Danny?
You're in a room, and when you start something, you finish it. So you didn't have 3 or 4 ideas going at one time. You had one that you turned into a song, then you went on to another one. Because the one thing I'm not good at is chewing gum and running at the same time. So if you spread me out too thin, nothing ever gets done. So that's what we did. 1 song at a time to completion. And when you had it, you recorded it.
So you almost did it in a Nashville style then?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
But like you said earlier, though, now you have these other 2 collaborators for you to help drive it and shape it and mold it into what the band wants it to be, though.
Exactly.
That's cool.
It's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
It was awesome. It was a great experience. I it's like anything, Sean. Not too many things I'd do again. but there are a lot of things I'd do again. And I think the process was just, it was so much fun, even mm-hmm. though it was a lot of work.
Right.
It was a lot of fun.
How is the wife and kids looking at you now, knowing that, because I mean, I'm sure they know the history, but now to see Dad going out with Uncle Heath and, you know, and everything and now seeing this and, you know, some of the things that are happening for you guys, because I mean, you're going to take this on the road for support, right?
That's right. And we're working on some contacts right now and what this all means, especially over in the UK. Believe it or not, that's really started to emanate. And what's great is I've had nothing but love and support from my family. I know a lot of guys who get out there doing this type of thing. That's where things fall apart. For me, it's never been that way. They were always raised around it. They knew about it. Their dad wasn't doing it all the time, but they knew their dad.
Yeah.
They know me. My wife knows who her husband is. Nobody else really knows me. My wife does. So when it comes down to this thing, it's just nothing but support. They know that in the heart of my heart of hearts that this would be my favorite thing
to do,
be doing. They know that. And as long as I keep even keel, make the right decisions, make reasonable ones, and with reasonable expectations, I think everything works out.
Yeah. And I think that's the key thing you said, because so many people – and I don't know, I might ruffle some feathers here, but there are certain women who marry musicians hoping for certain expectations of their husbands.
Yes.
And And you kind of hit the nail on the head, and that was one reason why Karen and I got married, is because when we first got together, we were actually a blind date, believe it or not. And so after the first 6 months, it's like going, okay, all right, you know, first year and a half, oh, you're still here. Okay. You know, 4 years down the road. Well, I guess we should be getting a little bit more serious then, huh? And, you know, so she's seen me, you know, perform in front of 5,000. She seen me perform in front of five people, and she was one of the five, including the two bartenders, and the drunk guy. So, you know, so she's seen it all. So it was just a matter of also of timing for me. I mean, my wife is my biggest supporter in the aspect, and it's weird that she goes, she backs off. Well, do what you want to do.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and, yeah. And it's awkward because you kind of go, okay, great. Well, I want to go do this. She goes, okay, go do it. Oh, you're serious. You want me to go do it? Because I am going to go do it. Well, go ahead. You know, you go, oh, shit, now I got to go do it, you know. And it was just so funny. And, you know, and God bless her. And that's one reason why I married her, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of miss a little bit of her when I do go out and perform every now and then, because my wife was my biggest pimp when I would go out and perform with the band. Because she would come after the show, she would say, you need to talk to those four girls over there. You need to talk to that couple over there. The elderly people in the back really liked you an awful lot. So you need to go talk to them. And it was hysterical and I loved it. And I would need to go out and talk to those people and, you know, get those, get that fan base.
And yeah. Everything. She really loves you.
Yeah.
And that's why she's doing that.
Yeah. And understands it, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
And it was great. So I think in that aspect, we're definitely both blessed, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And now with the kids, you know, are the kids playing music too right now, Larry, or no?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Lawrence is more of a jazz pianist type. He loves that. Oh, Ella's more of a singer. She likes the whole macro of the thing, uh-huh, more so. Lawrence is more of an instrumentalist where he likes to be a part of things, but he likes to sit down with the piano and just do his thing on jazz. Whereas Ella likes to be, you know, if she's going to be front and center and doing it, it has to be something she really wants to sing. And they just enjoy music. Uh-huh. They like it. That's what I want them to do. Enjoy it. Don't make it a career. Just enjoy it.
Yeah. Did you have to sit down and have that talk with them? Like, I don't mind if you do, but you got to do it for yourself, not for dad.
Yeah. Early on with Lawrence, because he started out on guitar. Uh-huh. And I just knew within a year he didn't like it. He wasn't taken to it. And I said, you don't have to do that. Uh-huh. Why are you doing that? What do you want to do? He goes, I want to play piano. I'm like, well, then go play piano. We'll put you up in lessons and learn it. Uh-huh. And the same way with Ella, you know, she still wants to play guitar. And I've got to make time to teach her some things so she can find out she might not like it.
Yeah. But like, hey, there's strings on there and you got to cut your nails.
Yeah. And it hurts.
Yeah, exactly. No, my son Roman's the same way. He's mainly singing. He sings in choir. He's been taking some private singing lessons. He's excelling at piano right now. I mean,
wow.
He kicks my butt in it. I mean, he's playing Journey on piano and I'm going, wait, how does it go again? Ah, shit. I'll just play the guitar part, you know?
Yeah.
you know, so, you know, he's excelling at that and I'm very, very proud of him for that. But yeah, I had to sit down and go, dude, look, you know, cause I knew, well, let me back up. When he was born, a lot of friends of mine came up and said, so you're going to teach him how to play guitar? And I went, no. And they go, why not? And I said, well, first of all, he's 2 days old. You know, I don't know what a two-day-old baby is going to learn about playing guitar right now. And, you know, but it was more or less of kind of like saying, look, his father is a musician. He's going to be in the element. It's going to be up to him to decide what to do it or not. My wife, Karen, has pushed him a little bit more than I've ever wanted. But he has taken it like a duck to water. He absorbs it like a sponge, basically, and very proud of him. But I had to tell him, I said, you got to do this for yourself. Don't do it to get on my good side. Don't do it for any other reason than you enjoy it, you know.
There you go.
And he does. And there's times when he's singing or whatever, and, I mean, he'll crack me up because he's just a good entertainer overall. He's doing these big rock movements, whatever, that we would see you know, like John Bon Jovi make or something or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What have you. And it cracks me up, you know, and I'm just going, cool. And when he does those, I look at him more as a peer than I do as my son and go, was it a good performance or bad performance? I didn't think it was that good, Dad. I said, yeah, it showed. What can you do next time to make it better? And we discuss it, you know. And,
right.
And then, but if he goes, yeah, it was a great performance, I said, yeah, it showed. You know, you did a great job, you know.
Awesome.
But again, what could you do to make it better?
You know, right.
Kind of a thing. So I give him all that positiveness and everything, too. And it's fun. And I do, you know, just love just watching him perform. It's fun, you know.
Yeah, not to mention he's using a different side of his brain that a lot of people don't get the opportunity to use, right? They really don't.
No, that's very true. Very true. Yeah, and so now he's just trying to decide, you know, what to go, and he'll be going to high school next year, and or later this year, rather, and so he still wants to go into choir, and now he's kind of picked up the guitar a little bit, he's kind of tinkered with it, but he's still excelling at piano, and I'm going, dude, go be the next Elton John if you want, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Just enjoy yourself, have a good time doing it.
Exactly, exactly. Cool. Well, Larry, before we let you go, buddy, I want to play a little game with you.
Okay.
Here, which is the island questions. I know I wanted to throw this curveball at you, basically. So basically, you're on a deserted island. You're finally retired, and you can only take one candy bar with you. What would it be?
Heath bar.
Heath bar. That's the second time we've had a Heath one recently.
Yeah, they're the best.
I don't think I've ever had a Heath bar.
You gotta have a Heath bar.
I'm missing
There's
out.
Nothing
then.
Better.
Yeah, they're not bad. They're not bad. They're not bad.
I will say this, by the way, the bar form is better than the little bite size ones. So.
Well, any bar form is better than a bite size. You only get a bite.
Well, yeah, but the bars, they have thicker chocolate layers on the bar size ones. I don't know why. So it's a thicker chocolate with the taffy middle.
Yeah. Oh, taffy. So they don't shrink it down. They just give you minimum then.
Yeah.
Well, that's yeah, ladies and gentlemen. When you go out and buy a Heath bar, make sure that you do buy the full size bar, not the bite size.
Yeah, it's much better.
Yeah, Sean.
All right. If you, God, I've been promoted, and he's banging on me, my producer, ladies and gentlemen. This is gonna be a tough one for you, Larry. You can only take one album with you on the island. What would it be?
Oh, you had to ask that question. Okay, so I'm deserted. I'm on a desert island.
Yeah.
But I'm retired, you said,
you're
right?
Yeah, you know.
Okay, so I'm not 16 or something like that.
No.
Okay. Oh, my. Okay, you're not going to laugh. I think you're going to think it's interesting. But I think I would take AC/DC, Back in Black.
That's a good album, though.
I think I would take that one.
See, mine was the New Monkees, but people laughed at me.
Yeah. The ass kiss
I don't know
the
how
best.
Anybody could listen to my voice when they're retired and on dessert. Yeah. I don't know about that. That's...
Well, you know, cause, hey, the way she moves is magic, dude. Come on.
Oh, yeah, don't get me.
All right. You can only take one movie with you, Larry. What would it be, bud?
Well, you ask questions that take some thought. What's wrong with you? What movie?
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank, total blank. I'm not a big movie guy or a movie buff,
uh-huh.
But I'd have to say I like the older movies better than newer ones.
Okay.
Newer ones.
All right.
So I'm not really giving you an answer, am I? This is not good.
You're delaying, and that's okay because you're thinking.
Yeah, well, It's a Wonderful Life I like.
Oh,
but that's more of a holiday movie.
That's still a good film, though.
All around.
Yeah.
It's a great film. It's got all the emotions in it. It's got a great storyline. It's got a great ending. It's got suffering in it. It's got everything.
Yeah.
It may not have explosions and stuff, but it's great.
Well, there's that one car crash, isn't there? But it doesn't blow up.
Oh, yeah.
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 All right. What type of food would you take, bud?
I'd take any form of pesto, anything. I don't care. Put pesto on it. I'm good.
Pesto. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Love it.
You could take one person for conversation's sake. It could be anybody in history, dead or alive. It cannot be your spouse, though. Who would you take?
You know, I'd love to be on an island talking to Rod Stewart.
Oh.
I don't know. I really would. I'd love to talk to him about his life and his career.
Yeah, he and I actually have something in common. He's into model trains.
He is?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there is a secret, I don't want to say society, but it's like a secret club that he has with other people at his house here in Beverly Hills and in England. And he has this huge, giant layout of HO scale trains. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. He was he was featured on two magazines dealing with model trains. And he goes, yeah, now instead of throwing panties, they actually people actually throw me like buildings and engines and stuff now or whatever. He goes, it's really weird. It's really weird. So Rod Stewart, that's a good one though, dude. That's a real good
one. Yeah, I do. I love his. I like his career. I like everything about it.
Okay, if you could take one person for sexual gratification, again, cannot be your spouse.
For sexual gratification?
Uh-huh.
Well, at our age, I think that turns into imaginative gratification anyways. So, you know, when I was growing up, it was Cheryl Teagues because I had a poster of her. Or Farrah Fawcett, you know?
I didn't care for Farrah Fawcett that much. I don't know what it was about her.
Well, I liked the one poster. Well, everybody liked the one poster.
Well, everybody liked the one poster, yeah. But it was the hair and the smile and the lean back is what it was. But I'll tell you, I'd take Catherine Bach and play Daisy Duke over Farrah Fawcett any day.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful lady.
Yeah.
Beautiful lady.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Mine is, what's her name? What's up? Drawing a blank again.
Cheryl Teagues.
No. I loved her.
Okay.
I love Christie Brinkley, but I liked Charlie's Angels. Catherine. Oh my gosh, I'm trying to. You know who she is. She had her own clothing line with Kmart and everything later in life. She's one of the most beautiful women.
Jacqueline Smith.
Jacqueline Smith, thank you.
You went for a brunette now.
Yeah, yep. I thought she was a beautiful lady. My wife thinks she's a beautiful lady. Everybody thinks she's a beautiful lady.
Yeah, she's still beautiful. Hell. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, last one. If you could go back and change anything in your childhood. If you could redo anything in your childhood, what would it be?
To know who God is.
Nice.
I wish I would have then.
Got it.
Sure. Just more opportunities in life would have come. More things. Ways to handle things would have been different. Expectations would have been different.
Got it.
I think I just would have been smarter and happier.
Got it. That's a good answer, dude.
Thanks.
That is very good. Very good answer. Very cool. And I know you're blessed, so.
I am. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You are too.
Yeah. My wife tells me every day, you know, so. Larry, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, brother. Such a wonderful conversation, everything. And, of course, we've been talking to Larry Saltis of the New Monkees, but more importantly, of a band called Color Vine with their new album called Wake Up. And, again, their brand new first single is called Victory Song, which I love. And of course you got to kind of debut it too. Actually, let's talk about this real briefly before you go, Larry. You got kind of debut it at the performance of the New Monkees acoustically.
Yes.
You know, and everybody in that room just loved it. Also,
that was really great, by the way. That made me just to, you know, stop. I think a couple lines I didn't even sing because they just, I couldn't believe someone knew the words, first off, knew the melodies and really liked it that much. And that's, I'm so grateful for that stuff. I mean, how many people get to do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, believe
me. You were there.
Yeah.
You were there. It was just a great experience.
Yeah. And I mean, that crowd just really accepted you guys in ways that I think should have been accepted years ago. Because, again, we all know how the TV show went, but I think just as musicians and the talent that you guys have individually, of course, we still question Jared. But Jared knows I say it with love. You know, just the talent that you guys have, we can see why the producers of the originals picked you guys. And kudos on all of that. And then also to have Mickey Dolenz with you guys to finally go, yeah, they're cool, you know, after all these years and so much bullshit and egos go under the bridge, so to speak, basically. No, this is a great album. Again, the band is called Color Vine. Wake Up is a brand new album. Victory Song is their new single, and go out and get it. CDBaby.com, I believe.
That's right. And colorvineband.com is the website. You can get everything you need right through the website. It's really great.
Yeah.
Our good buddy Doug Osbury put that all together for us. He's just a wonderful guy, and he's the front man now. He's the man at large. So if you guys get on the website, anything you need is right there.
There you go. Check it out. It's great music, and I mean I'm definitely enjoying it. I'm probably going to learn a couple of songs myself and cover them. So it's that good, you know. And then later on, I still need you to teach me how to play The Way She Moves is Magic, because I'm still trying to figure that damn song out.
I'll tell you what, we can cover that very quickly.
It's all in A.
It's all in A.
It's all in A.
We can do it.
Yeah.
We can do it, brother.
It's easy.
Now, the Color Mind stuff is similar, but it's just, it's one of those things I think you'll really like more.
Oh, I think, I know, absolutely. Absolutely, you know. But no, it's a really good album, so if you guys can go out and get it, again, it's colorvine.com and also cdbaby.com. Check them out, Colorvine. Larry Saltis, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, buddy.
Thank you, Sean. Love you, brother.
Love you.
Have a good day.
You too, buddy, and love to the wife and kids.
Thank you. You as well. To Roman and Karen.
All right. Take care. Today's guest was first introduced to us on the Mark and Brian program about 20 years ago. And since then, he's charmed all of us here in Southern California with not only his warm voice, but also with his acting skills. And we've seen him on One Tree Hill. He's played Elvis in opposite of Joaquin Phoenix in Walk the Line. And you'll also get to see him in the upcoming film, A Christmas Wish on Lifetime. Please welcome to our show, the talented Mr. Tyler Hilton. How are you, Tyler?
What up, guys? How you doing?
Good, hey. Brother. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm a little bit tired, to be honest.
And where are you calling out today, Tyler?
I only got one niece. She's a year and a half. And, oh, my God. For you parents out there, I've got new respect for you. The night with a year and a half-year-old, I was like, I'm more exhausted than when I've been on the road for like 2 months.
It's a completely different lifestyle, huh?
Yeah, it's like a whole different thing. But anyway, we had a blast. But I was excited to call you guys today and say hey.
Oh, cool. You know, thank you so much for doing it. I caught your interview with Mark about 2-3 weeks ago and everything. And I just wanted to say, what a great interview that was.
Dude, it was so great. I mean, it was such a cool vibe for me, too. My dad called afterwards and was like, dude, that was such a great interview. I actually didn't know a lot of those stories. And I thought, that's funny. Didn't I told Mark afterwards, too. I was like, dude, I literally forgot we were on air because he hadn't caught up in so long. I felt like we were just talking. And his studio was set up at his house.
Right.
So we're just sitting there catching up for the first time. He told me, too. He was like, when I first saw him before we got on the air, he was like, look, I'm a big fan of Save It for the Air. So don't tell me anything that you're going to tell me on the air. Let's just keep it fresh. So when we were talking, we were just catching up for the first time. It was great. But I had such a blast.
Yeah, and the songs you played, man, they sounded great. I'm loving it. And obviously, I follow your career ever since I've heard you, since you were, you know, 15, 16 years old on with Mark and Brian. And I got to tell you, too, you and I have actually crossed paths a couple of times. Basically,
no way.
Yeah. There was one time right after you were on Mark and Brian, my wife and I went down to go see you in Hermosa Beach when you performed at a Barnes and Noble one time.
Oh my God!
and then back in 2004, we caught up with you again at the NAMM show. You were performing at the Sennheiser booth. And so caught up with you there. So yeah, and so, you know, it's just nice to see your career just kind of, you know, take off the way it did. And I know we don't have too much time with you, so let me ask you this, Tyler. How does a young boy from Palm Springs fall in love with Elvis and start playing the blues?
You know, I don't know what it was about the blues that got me so amped. I know my parents on one of their, you know, my mom was a teacher, so in the summers we kind of took off and just went on road trips around the country because it was a cheap way to kind of have a summer vacation. And she was great about stopping at all these cool places. And one of the places we stopped was Graceland.
Uh-huh.
And, my sister went also, and she walked away from there being like, cool, it was just another museum. I don't really care. But I was totally struck by Elvis, by his image, by the music that I heard there. And I was young enough to not care about what was cool or what wasn't. You know, obviously Elvis wasn't cool with my age group. So I don't know what, like, got me so into him. But through Elvis, you know, if you get into someone like Elvis, you're going to get into like a whole breadth of American music. You got country music, you got gospel, you got early blues, you know, like in the 50s and the kind of stuff they were doing at Sun Records before Elvis came around. Uh-huh. And, you know, you got rock and roll, you got all this stuff. So I just kind of would find things like the song That's All Right Mama or Midnight Train or these kind of songs, and I just love them, and then kind of end up hearing about blues guys that recorded them, and then, you know, would listen to the original blues guys. And I just, there's something in me that always felt like I just identified with old black blues men from the 30s and 40s. I don't know what it was. It was just like that music like killed me when I was a kid. It just was totally connected with me on a whole different level. So I don't know. It's just something, I feel like everybody is exposed to blues at some point. Mm-hmm. Everyone's exposed to everything at some point, but it depends on what you've kind of got a natural bent towards that'll kind of hook you in. And I just got hooked in, and I couldn't let it go. And that's how I ended up on Mark and Brian and everything. Cause you know, I anyone who's playing the blues, especially if they were my age, I got obsessed with, like Johnny Lang. Uh-huh. And so I don't know. It's just a weird thing. There's just something about it that really got me.
I think the thing that always amazed me with you is that here you were at that time period, we're talking 20 years ago, that you were 15, 16 years old, but you had a voice that sounded in his 20s, you know, a voice that...
Oh, did I? Wow, that's crazy.
You know, and to me, you know, when I was listening to you with Mark, you said, wow, my voice has changed a little bit. And yeah, there's been some maturity there, but I mean, the stylistic has pretty much remained the same over the years, I think. And that's one thing I've always liked about you yourself was just the way your voice sounded. It has this airy rasp at the same token. You're combining two different things into one, which I always really enjoyed.
Man, I really appreciate that. I don't really have like control over it. And I'm also like kind of, it's hard for me to be objective because it's just the voice coming out of me all the time. But yeah, when I heard that Mark and Brian thing, I was like shocked at how different I sounded. And so it's cool to hear from you that you've kind of heard me being consistent the whole time. That's really cool. Yeah. I don't know what genre it is. It's funny. It's like Mark was asking me too off the air, like, what do people say you are? Like country or pop or blues or rock or what is it? I don't know. It's one of those questions I can never figure out.
You're just a good songwriter overall. And I think, you know, and Mark says this, and I've always said it myself too, being a musician as well, is that once a song, if a song is good on an acoustic guitar and it holds and people can connect with it, it's a good song. It doesn't make a difference what genre it is. It's a good song.
Yeah.
And you've proven that with your albums through the years of just being a good songwriter overall, you know.
Oh, man.
And speaking of new albums right now, your latest album here, City on Fire, it seems to be a little bit of a departure from your normally what you've done. Was this a growth album for you, and did you do something a little bit different?
I wasn't trying to. I mean, I guess if there was anything that was different between the last record and this one, is I feel a little more unbridled, I guess. You know, like this record was probably the first record I made where I didn't go in to make a record. I was just, writing songs when I had time and recording them in the studio with my buddy Jocko and my other buddy Charles Kelly from Lady Antebellum. We were kind of just doing songs as we had time and no plan for a record because I'm independent. I was filming a couple TV shows and I was just kind of focused on the acting thing. But I tell you what, I keep learning something in life, and I don't know if you guys have ever noticed this, and maybe it's just me, but it feels like when I'm not paying attention to something, it's the same way when I was single when I was young. Uh-huh. It's like if I acted like I didn't like a girl, she was like all into it. And it's the same thing with like opportunities in life. When I'm not paying attention, some of my best work happens. And that's why I kind of like going back and forth between acting and music. I'll be on, because I think this is one of my best records, and I wrote it while I was paying attention to all this acting stuff I was doing. Mm-hmm. Other records, I've gone into the studio and been like, okay, now it's time to record a record, you know? And right. It just sounds so tried. And there's something about, I don't know, like having a indifference to a project you're working on that I think brings a cockiness to it that you can't really fake, you know? And that sometimes true indifference like creates some of the best stuff. And that's what this record was. I was literally writing these songs while I was focused on something else. And that is true, I think, subconscious. That's when I think you get the most real songs, you get the most all this stuff when you're not sitting there going, hey, what do I want people to know that I'm thinking right now? No, it's just like I'm writing songs because that's part of like my therapeutic process. Mm-hmm. And one day I wake up and I'm like, holy shit. Can we say shit?
Where's the podcast, absolutely.
Right? I was like, holy shit. I've got a record here. So in that way, it was the purest record I've ever made for that reason. But so I don't know. So maybe that was the unbridled part of it. I was just making stuff up. I was pitching songs to TV shows. I was pitching songs to avenues that had nothing to do with the radio. And the sky was the limit. I had no genre constraints. I had no band constraints. Just anything I wanted to do, I was kind of doing. So I was just having some fun on it.
So this is, you said this is like your first independent release then, or?
No, no, it's probably my third. And I started my own label like maybe 8 years ago. And I just put all my records out through that. But the cool thing about it is since it was an independent release, I had no timetable and I could just kind of cut out a record if I want to. And, you know.
So, so then how was that freedom then? Because you were signed originally, I think, to Warner Brothers. So how was that freedom compared to where I'm sure Warner Brothers said, hey, look, we love you, we like you, we heard you on Mark and Brian, but at the same token, hey, maybe you need to play this kind of music versus this kind. I'm sure there was some kind of constraints. Was there a little bit of relief leaving Warner Brothers to do your own label?
There were so many constraints at Warner, it was crazy. It was actually a really tough period of my life artistically because I was signed to them for almost 10 years and I released one record.
Oh my
and
God.
And in that time I got signed to them when I was probably 18 or 19 and I left them at probably 28 or so. And in that time I'd recorded maybe four records that just didn't come out. And it was so tough for me because I didn't realize this at the time. And, you know, I still probably would have done it over again if I had the choice because, you know, that's such a big opportunity and, you know, whatever. But if they don't release one of your records or your songs, you can't release them otherwise. So you have no choice but to only be able to release songs that they approve, you know? So like you guys in the studio or my fans or anyone, you can only hear a song that I wrote publicly if they allow it. So I was writing like hundreds of songs, but because they didn't, you know, follow a certain genre that was worth it for them to put all their marketing dollars behind, like a real straight ahead pop album or a real straight ahead country record. They were kind of like, look, man, like keep writing. You know, we're not really in the business of releasing these like kind of independent in between genre kind of records and just kind of grassroots in it. So I just had my hands tied for a long time and I kept trying to give them the hits they wanted. And I felt like it felt fake to me. And I don't think people believed it from me. And the songs that I loved that I really felt that my fans liked, they didn't want to put the money behind. So it just came to a head at one point. Everybody at the label kept getting fired and I was working with a new team. It felt like every year, finally they fired the president that had, you know, stopped me and hired a new president. It was like my third president I'd worked for under Warner. And I was like, look, if you guys are looking for artists to drop, just drop me. Like I'm in my late 20s. I've been trying to do this with you guys for a decade. Yeah. Let me just put out my own music and at least put out something new so I can get on the road. Or else, you know, this whole thing is going to get killed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's tough. I mean, those are the pluses and minuses of being on a major label like that. So, but like, you know, like you said, now you're on the independent, you know, you can do what you want. I know Debbie Gibson years ago did the same thing where, you know, she has her own record label, you know, and she can do what she wants and put out when she wants it also. And have no artistic constraint at all whatsoever. So, which is good, which is definitely good. On this album, though, Tyler,
it is, and it forces you to ask yourself, like, I didn't realize how important putting out my own music was until push came to shove. I know a lot of people that have been in that situation, and they thought, you know what, I can rise to the occasion, I can write better pop songs, I can relook at the way I look at myself as an artist, and I can have some real success. And I've seen a bunch of people that I came up with just totally take off because they were able to do that. With me, there was just something about the songs that I was singing that I just didn't want to stop singing. And I come from a family of songwriters and, you know, I probably could be driving a, you know, big old bulletproof Tesla or something if I could get my shit together. But I, you know, it was just like, this was like, I just really wanted to double down on this music and I really wanted to make it happen. So it was interesting that was kind of so important to me. I didn't realize it until that moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this new album that you got, City on Fire, you have a new single called When the Night Moves. How did that song come to be?
Actually, I've been touring with this girl, Kate Vogel, a couple of years leading up to making the record. And we were just clicking together musically. We've been friends forever. We're on One Tree Hill together. But we were spending every day on the road together and just really getting along, and the music was singing tight. So I wanted to bring her in the studio and do some songs with her. And we wrote that one day. It just kind of felt like the kind of song we didn't have live that we wanted live, something that really summed up our kind of like live show together, which is like really trying to move the audience and you know, just all get really close together and kind of sing. So that's how that came about. And then just yesterday, I can't even believe I'm remembering this because I'm awful at this stuff. I just released another single. It's a Christmas song called Drunk on Christmas. It just came out yesterday.
I saw that on Facebook. Yeah.
It's a fun little, actually, it's probably the first record or first song to come out from the new record. I've got like a batch of 10 songs that I accidentally couldn't stop writing as I was working on Sitting on Fire. And so they're going to be the next record. And we did this Christmas song in that session with that band. It sounds great. It's all jazzy and kind of fun.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, Tyler, you've got three shows coming up. November 22nd, you're going to be at St. Rock in Hermosa Beach. That's also your birthday show, and I'm going to be going to that one because that's actually about 15 minutes away from where I work at, so I'm very excited to see you there.
Great. That's awesome.
And then on November 23rd, you're headed down to San Diego and be performing at La Stats West Music Venue. And then November 24th, you'll be at the you're coming back up to Orange County and be performing at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano. All great venues. I've played at those venues myself.
Cool.
What kind of show will we see when we go to these venues? Is it going to be a full band, or is it going to be a little bit more intimate?
It's going to be intimate, and it's going to be a special kind of show. I love doing these in Southern California. It's going to be acoustic, just me and Kate Vogel on acoustic. And there's going to be, you know, a lot of stories. We end up talking a lot more than we probably should, but we just end up chatting so much on stage. And I think the fans dig it. We have a good time doing it. This weekend will be cool because Kate and I haven't been on the road all year. We haven't been out since last year. It's just been me out there promoting City on Fire. She moved to France for a little while and was working on her new record. And so this weekend is going to be the first time we've really got to catch up and play music together in a long time. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I feel like we got a lot of catch up on, even on stage. So it's going to be a fun vibe. Now, I will say St. Rock and the Stats are going to probably sell out. So if you guys want to grab tickets, I'd grab those sooner than later.
Okay.
But the Coach House is huge, so I think there's probably going to be room.
Yeah, and I was talking to Corey, which I think is your road manager, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so talk to Corey, and basically we're able to give away three pairs of tickets to see Tyler at the Coach House November 24th, but you have to answer this question. And earlier Tyler mentioned Lady Antebellum, so the question is to all of our listeners is, what does Tyler Hilton and Lady Bellum have in common? Is it A, Tyler was in one of their videos, B, they were roommates, C, they all have the same shoe size, or D, none of the above? So don't give away the answer. Don't give away the answer, Tyler, because I know what the answer is because I heard it on Mark. But you can send all your answers. Email your answers to yourweeklydose1@gmail.com. Leave your name and your phone number, and the first three people to get that answer right will get to go see Tyler at the Coach House, and which is a great venue. I love that place, and for that type of a show, it's going to be awesome.
That is one of the coolest venues in Southern California. If you guys haven't been to there, whether it's my show or whatever, you got to see one because it's a staple of a venue. It's incredible.
Now, you still live here in L.A., in the L.A. area, do you not?
Yeah.
Cool. You know, I was hoping, because when I was talking to Corey, I was hoping that we would get you to come in next week while you're on your way going down to San Diego, because you got to pass my house to get to San Diego anyway.
Yes, you know what? We were talking about that, and the reason we couldn't make it work is we've also sell these VIP packages before the show. So there's a meet and greet before the show that's for sound check. And then I'm also getting together with fans for coffee earlier in the day. And you can buy tickets for a little coffee hang we're going to do together for earlier in the afternoon. You can get tickets on my website. But that's why we couldn't do it.
Okay. Well, you know what? Real quick, talk about that. The coffee with Tyler. What is that about?
You know, the fans kind of wanted to have, they've been really digging these like extra experiences we're doing on the road. We try things sometimes, different merch items, and some fans dig them, some fans don't. This one, we just said, you know, in one of our big markets, it might have been Chicago or somewhere in Texas, we said, like, let's try seeing if, like, a few fans want to come and just meet for coffee earlier in the day. It'd be a really cool opportunity for me to get a talk to just six people at a time as opposed to tons of people that come to the soundcheck meet and greet. Uh-huh. And so we just tried it, and I loved it. Sometimes things can be really draining for me, especially when you're on the road, but I had such a blast, like, just getting to spend 45 minutes with these fans, talking about what they did, them asking me questions about what I'm doing, and it was so intimate and cool, and the fans dug it, too, and so we've done it in just about every city we go on tour in, And it's like one of my favorite parts of the day now, honestly. It's a real cool vibe.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know we're on limited time with you, and it's almost time to go for you. Can we get you at some point when I know how busy you are, though, Tyler, but at some point to get you in the room with us, though?
I would love to. You know what? Oh, we'll link you up with Corey, and we'll find a time that would work, but that'd be so fun.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I know you got your own guitars, but I've got a stack here that's of Takaminis that are just waiting to be played. They all got new strings, and Steve's bangs his knees up against them every now and then. Mm. But love to just sit and jam with you, and I'm so looking forward on seeing you for your birthday show and at the Coach House also.
Dude, I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me on, and you guys have great taste in radio because Mark and Brian are... maybe you guys are a close second, but they're the best radio hosts definitely out there.
We'll definitely settle for that, you know, because we start doing this mainly because a lot of people miss the guys, and we get it, and we try to have some of the same guests that they had on and everything. And when I saw that you were going to be in town, I'm like, you know what, I got to email your management and at least get you in the room. If not, at least get you on the phone. And we did that. And next time, we got to get you in the room next time, though, Tyler.
Dude, I would love to. And that Mark's podcast has been great, too. I will say that, like, I was a fan of his for so long before I was on the show. And those guys have lived up to everything they seem like on the air. They are in real life. And, you know, Mark always came across as a real family guy and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So much of the time that's BS in Hollywood. I mean, everyone that has that outward appearance is usually the total opposite, you know. Right. I find all the people that play the bad guys are the nicest, and all the people that play the good guys are the worst.
Yeah,
and, like, you know, it's just, but with Mark, it's real. Like, I sat and talked to him about family life, and, you know, I've been married for a while, and, you know, we've talked about starting a family and stuff. And he is such an amazing family dude. And his daughter is hitting me up. I got to hang with his wife. And it's just like, what a great family. He's a true inspiration to be doing what he did for that many years and be that successful and keep that together the way he has. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, he did a wonderful job with it. And, you know, he's been very gracious with us. He came on our anniversary show one year, and we did about an hour interview with him. And then when Brian found out that Mark was on, Brian came on, and he did, again, an hour with us as well.
So, wow.
You know, both of those guys, they have blessed this show and were very proud and humbled that we are kind of continuing their tradition, which is what we wanted to do, specifically for those who missed the guys, you know, because it was a special show. 25 years in Los Angeles, you know, that's a hell of a long time, 27 years together. And to not get their fame go to their heads. And that's one thing I noticed about you too, Tyler. You know, young boy, Palm Springs, you've done it. You've reached a certain pinnacle, certain things in your career, and you've been very blessed yourself, but yet you have remained humble as well.
I appreciate that, you guys. Thank you. And thanks for having me on to promote all this stuff. That's really cool.
Absolutely, Tyler.
Look forward to hanging on Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I will be there because you're like 15 minutes from my work, so I will get there early.
Cool.
All right,
Can't
Tyler.
Can't wait. All right, well, see you guys.
All right, buddy. You take care of yourself, and we'll see you on Friday.
All right, thanks, guys. See you later.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Well, once again, guys, thank you so much for joining us today for our Past Moments show. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Larry Saltis of the New Monkees and Colorvine, and also actor-singer Tyler Hilton. Catch us next week, guys. Be good to each other. Have fun. Take care. I wish I knew then what I know today. I'm on my way back home again. Love, that's what's waiting.
Thank you for listening to this week's show. Don't forget to support the show by shopping on Amazon. Just go to our website, yourweeklydose.com, click on the Amazon banner, and bookmark. Then start shopping. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at yourweeklydose1 and Facebook at yourweeklydose. We'll see you next week.